At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Maybe, just maybe, this economy is not going to be on its own anymore. That'd be nice, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today, the very first day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin today with some interrelated, interlocking parts that might affect the short and medium-term future in this economy, and then a disconnect, which honestly could do the same thing. Item number one, there are new murmurings on Capitol Hill of a maybe, possibly, could-be deal for some kind of new virus relief for this economy. That is about all we're going to say on that, because as you know, we've been down this road before with relief plans. But it does get us to item number two. Janet Yellen, in her first official remarks as Treasury Secretary nominee, may be giving Congress a little poke in the eye.
Inaction will produce a self-reinforcing downturn, causing yet more devastation.
So that's the maybe there is help on the way news of the day. The oh no, there's not came to us from Fed Chair Jay Powell and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin in congressional testimony this morning, summing up their views on the state of this economy. And as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains, there is a disconnect.
If you watched Chair Powell and Secretary Mnuchin's Senate Banking Committee testimony today, and I know you did, you'd think they were talking about two different economies. First, Mnuchin said,
"The October jobs report showed that the economy has gained back 12 million jobs since April."
And Powell followed up with,
"Although we welcome this progress, we will not lose sight of the millions of Americans who remain out of work."
Powell looks at the big picture. Mnuchin is focused on the letter of the law. And the CARES Act did specify that some pandemic aid stop at the end of the year as the economy recovered. Mnuchin acknowledges that some additional help is needed, but he also points to the falling unemployment rate. Catherine Judge is a law professor at Columbia University.
We'll look at where we are this quarter relative to last quarter and say, look at the rate of improvement.
The unemployment rate did fall to 6.9% in October, but that's still almost double the jobless rate before the pandemic hit the U.S. Adam Ozimek, chief economist at the jobs website Upwork, says Powell sees the glass as half empty, while Mnuchin says it's half full. And Mnuchin's optimism could make it harder to convince wavering members of Congress to vote for another relief package.
You can't really rally the troops as long as you're describing the glasses half full.
If Congress doesn't pass another relief bill, Williams College economist Ken Kuttner says the Fed will say,
"Look, if you guys can't get your act together and pass some fiscal stimulus, you know, it's going to fall to the Fed to try to take out that slack as best we can."
And Kuttner says the Fed's tools are not ideal for that. Fed Chair Powell has said repeatedly the Fed makes loans, not the grants that struggling businesses and jobless workers need right now. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaking of jobs, by the way, Friday morning brings us the November unemployment report. More now, actually, about jobs, because we told you the other day about how some states have been overpaying unemployment benefits and are asking people to pay that money back. Turns out some states have also been underpaying people who are on pandemic unemployment assistance. That's the program for freelancers and gig workers. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more on a report from the Government Accountability Office.
Pandemic unemployment assistance is a new program. And when it was created back in March, state unemployment offices had to scramble to get it up and running. Because of that, Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation says,
"In the beginning, everyone was getting the minimum benefit because states were moving this out very quickly and they wanted to get the benefit in people's hands."
The idea was that states would eventually go back, look at people's tax returns or other proof of income to calculate how much they should actually be getting, and then adjust their benefits accordingly. But in a lot of cases, Stettner says,
many workers have not gotten their benefits readjusted, even if they have successfully sent in their tax returns.
A majority of states have been paying people the minimum benefit instead of the actual amount they're eligible for, according to the GAO. How much people are being underpaid varies by state. Ann Paxton is with the Unemployment Law Project in Washington State.
In many states with decent benefit amounts, people are being underpaid by hundreds of dollars.
Every month. Some states are starting to go back and recalculate benefits, says Michelle Evermore at the National Employment Law Project.
Hopefully, what that means is that this month, as benefits may be winding down, at least some people will get some notification that they get a lot of back pay.
But she says people who are on PUA should be proactive and ask their state to recalculate their benefit and not assume it will happen automatically. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Wall Street to start the month? Pandemic? What pandemic? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This economy, as you know, because we tell you all the time, depends on American consumers consuming. So it stands to reason that American companies count on American consumers, too. And while we have largely stepped up, we being consumers, the pandemic has introduced no small amount of uncertainty into our spending habits. So a lot of American companies have started looking at Chinese consumers to keep them afloat. But as Marketplace's Jennifer Pack reports from Shanghai, Chinese consumers have a lot going on, too.
In the commercial district of Shanghai, an American firm sets up a test kitchen to put its twist on a Chinese classic, golden fried rice. Chef Yang Beichuan covers a bowl of cooked rice with a thick yellow mixture.
With the rice, make sure the rice absorbs enough liquid of the egg we have, and then you can fry it like this.
The egg he's referring to comes not from chickens, but rather mung beans. It's a plant-based egg, and the U.S. startup behind it and this cooking demo is Eat Just. CEO Joshua Tetrick says China was part of its business plan from day one.
About 1.4 trillion eggs are laid and consumed every year, and about 30% of all those eggs are laid and consumed in China. The U.S. is a little bit less than 10%.
China's market is not only big, but the authorities have the pandemic controlled enough that the firm could hold this cooking demo, where masks are optional. About a dozen potential customers showed up, like retiree Hua Meiying.
When I buy food, I care more about whether it's nutritional. That's even more important now with the pandemic.
Consumers like her helped China's retail sales bounce back in August for the first time since the COVID-19 pandemic hit. Spending increased 4.3% in October over the same month last year. But to get Chinese consumers to spend more might be tough. A lot of them save for things like medical costs. At a retirement home in Shanghai, 83-year-old Mao Xiuzhen plays mahjong on a smart tablet. She says she and her husband, both retired government doctors, had $750,000 in savings, but all that is gone.
My husband was sick for 3 years. We had to move from one rehabilitation facility to another every 2 months. He had 6 strokes in 3 years, became paralyzed at a nursing home, and passed away a few months ago.
Luckily, she still has a pension that covers her stay at a new government retirement home. Another big expense for Chinese consumers, children's education, like extra English lessons on weekends. Zhang Xiaowu's 6-year-old attends a few different outside lessons, adding up to $3,000 a year. And if he wants to get his son into the best schools in Shanghai, he needs to buy a property here.
But apartments in Shanghai are too expensive. And even if I have money, it would take me 5 to 6 years just to qualify to buy one.
That's because of China's strict residential registration system. it doesn't grant full rights in the city to people from the countryside, like Zhang Xiaowu. So he has to earn points in Shanghai, like upgrade his technical diploma to a bachelor's degree. That'll cost another $3,000 a year. He also has to make sure he and his employer have paid fully into the city's social welfare fund. If not, he has to make up for the shortfall. Back at the cooking demo, participant Selena Yuan has just popped a tofu plant-based egg roll into her mouth.
It's very tasty. It has the same texture as chicken eggs.
But a bottle of plant-based egg right now costs $7 in China, double what it's selling for in America. It's too pricey, says Selena Yuan, compared to regular chicken eggs. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Heading into these last critical 3 or 4 weeks of the retail year, people running independent retail are doing what they can to drum up business. So here with today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Hannah Oliver Depp. I'm a independent bookstore owner based in Washington, D.C. Our bookstore is Loyalty Bookstores. We began appointment shopping a month ago. It's been great to hear how our resilient, loyal, patient customers are doing from their mouths. But frankly, it's a bit terrifying. You think about what will happen to your staff, your community, almost before you think about what's going to happen to you. I will say that it is more lucrative than shipping books. People simply buy more, and they buy more things that have a better sales margin when they're in person. Nobody knows they need a sticker with Lizzo's face on it until they walk in and they see it at the counter. I mean, they might know, but they might not know that we have it, right? So the supply chain has been wrecked by COVID. Books are often bound and shipped to us from outside of the country into publisher and wholesaler warehouses that we then order from. The issues that we were facing were a long time coming, actually, in the publishing and bookselling industry. Every holiday season for the last 5 years, there's been a substantial issue getting certain cookbooks, art books, even some bigger name fiction books, because they just couldn't print them fast enough. And when they did, somehow mysteriously, they were at Amazon before they were at independent bookstores. All the pandemic has done is shine a horrifyingly clear spotlight on every inequality in our community. And my community is the book community. So when book printing shortages come, when people lose their jobs, when the death rate skyrocketsin the community and it adversely affects Black and brown people, the undocumented, those are the people whose stories I'm interested in telling, and they're my direct community that I'm trying to provide books to. Our business model should not work. It does because our community is ride or die for us. I can't just say, you know what, you lost your job, here's a free book, and stay in business. So I have to find really creative ways to figure out how to get books to my community, to support activists in my community, and we're doing our best.
That's Hannah Oliver Depp selling books in Washington, D.C. Do us a favor, would you tell us how your economy is doing at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up,
I didn't really see a lot of people that look like me.
Who is and who isn't on congressional staffs. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 185 points today, 0.6%, 29,823. The NASDAQ up 156, 1.2%, 12,355. The S&P 500 added, I don't know why I say five like that, that's weird. Anyway, the S&P 500 added 40 points, 1.1%, 36.62. Never listen to yourself, okay? Cosmetics company Sephora announced it's going to be moving into Kohl's department store, starting with 200 locations late next year, and its products will be sold on Kohl's website. Kohl's polished up 13.4 today. Sephora's parent, French luxury brands firm LVMH, brightened 3.3%. Oh, by the way, Salesforce officially announced today it's buying Slack, so there's that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast, How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is a lot going on in oil and gas right now. OPEC is talking this week with oil-producing allies about whether to keep on limiting production next quarter as it has been doing since May. ExxonMobil, we learned yesterday, is cutting spending on finding new oil and drilling for that oil and could write off as much as $20 billion with a B dollars worth of its investments in natural gas. The proximate cause, of course, is demand just being crushed by the pandemic and, to boot, a political transition in this country to get ready for. As I said, it's a lot, but lucky for us, we've got Marketplace's Andy Euler to break it all down.
Okay, let's start with OPEC. Sarah Vakshiri is president of the industry consultancy SVB Energy.
The current meeting of OPEC is a very sensitive and very hard for the members to come to a consensus about what would be exactly the supply and demand prospects in the first quarter of next year.
The Russians want to put more oil onto the market. The Saudis worry that too much supply will depress prices.
And then you pile on top of that all of the government uncertainty or regulatory uncertainty.
That's Timothy Fitzgerald, a former economist on the Council of Economic Advisors in the Trump administration. He says much depends on the stance of the incoming U.S. presidential administration, which could bring
potentially a very different direction of policy with respect to the oil and gas industry.
This at a time when the COVID-19 pandemic is depressing demand and fossil fuels are less popular. Tom Sanzillo is with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
The industry is cash-starved, the declining assets, the maturing industry, with a negative outlook.
Mark Finley at Rice University, though, says international oil companies shouldn't throw in the towel just yet.
It is still the case that oil and gas combined are over half of the world's total energy needs.
He says the task for oil companies right now is to keep providing affordable energy while at the same time transitioning their business to meet the demands of a carbon-free future. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Whatever's going on in Washington now with virus relief, come January 3rd, there's going to be a whole new Congress sworn in, so a whole new set of negotiating to do. The incoming Congress, it'll be the 117th, if you're counting, will be one of the most diverse ever, although, to be clear, far less diverse than the people they represent. Also, remarkably not diverse, the people behind the scenes in Congress, the staffers who make a lot of what happens there, happen. Dr. LaShonda Brenson is a senior fellow of diversity and inclusion at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, where she studies congressional staff. And given that a new Congress means hiring season on Capitol Hill, we thought this might be a good time for a talk. Dr. Brenson, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Very good to have you on. Let me ask you to go back to however many years ago it was that you were an intern on Capitol Hill, and you looked around, and what did you see?
I didn't really see a lot of people that looked like me. I did a Washington semester program, and I interned with a member of Congress, and I was really excited about the opportunity, but I just didn't see a lot of staffers who looked like me.
You have since gone on to study in this field. You've been doing this for a while now, studying Congress and congressional staffers and the diversity issue. What do you see today when you look around Capitol Hill?
Much of the same, unfortunately. Huh. People of color nearly are 40% of the U.S. population, but in the Senate, they only represent about 11% of the top staff positions. And while the House is a bit better at 14%, in those top positions, there really is not much diversity still, unfortunately.
Let me ask you, just for clarification's sake, to talk about what those top staff positions are, right? Because we're not looking at, you know, the person getting the mail, right?
Yeah. These are the most senior staff positions in Congress. So that includes chief of staff, legislative director, and communications director. These staffers, as you know, are so important because they are the ones who are really doing the day-to-day task, giving talking points, giving notes, informing their member on various issues that might arise. Of course, members of Congress make the final say, but these staffers really have a lot of influence in enacting legislation.
Right, and has a huge impact in this economy. Let me ask you, though, how to fix it, because is this, as they say in Silicon Valley all the time, they say, oh, man, it's a pipeline problem. We just don't have enough engineers of color or who are women coming along. Is that what's going on here?
I think in some instances, yes, but I do think that there is evidence that shows that there also is a lack of promotion opportunities within offices, right? And so some instances and some offices, they're not getting the promotion opportunities that they need. And there actually are a lot of initiatives on the Hill that collect resumes and can recommend candidates to offices. And so there's a lot more resources now that these offices can rely on.
With a change of administrations coming in January, one imagines that the Biden administration will suck in some number of people from Capitol Hill. That would seem to provide an opportunity, right?
Yeah, and I think that there are a lot of opportunities in terms of those staffers also leaving their current positions, but also just a lot of opportunity given the newly elected members of Congress as well. And so we're writing op-eds and reports to kind of inform these new members, especially why this is so important.
Just as a close here, if you had a chance to talk to a 20-year-old intern on Capitol Hill today about this issue, would you say that by the time that person reaches your stage in life, it'll be better?
I certainly hope so. I think that there are a lot of room for opportunity. You know, if you think about everything going on in terms of the attention and different issues that affect communities of color, there's a lot more opportunity for these policymakers to respond to the needs of their constituents.
Well, let's hope so. Dr. LaShonda Brenson, she is a senior fellow of diversity and inclusion at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. Dr. Brenson, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Some college students, undergrads and graduate students, have deferred their enrollments, hoping they will get to have an actual in-person experience once schools open, whenever that may be. While they wait, though, they are still finding ways to connect. Alana Strauss has that one.
Over the summer, MIT's Urban Planning Program held a meeting for incoming graduate students. Some were still deciding whether or not to defer. Ezra Glenn, an MIT lecturer, immediately noticed there was something different about these students.
We sort of expected it would be similar to, you know, an admissions open house or sort of thing. It'd be, you know, a bunch of students awkwardly not knowing each other and maybe tripping over themselves, being polite, getting out of each other's way.
Instead, the students had already gotten to know each other virtually. They'd been working together to prepare for the meeting.
It turned out they showed up very well organized. It almost felt like we were having, you know, a public meeting at City Hall, and here was a citizens group that came that had clearly organized ahead of time.
Glenn says 40 of the 60 students decided to defer, but that doesn't mean those students lost touch with each other. They've continued to meet regularly. They created an urban planning book club with their cohort that meets once a month on Zoom. About 10 people showed up at this meeting where Jimena Muzio and Mackenzie Human discussed evictions during the pandemic.
The current situation justifies, I don't know, occupying somebody else's property, even though it's vacant or whatever. Like, I'm just wondering myself.
No, I find myself in a similar kind of like moral gray area.
The students also organized a film club, monthly lecture series, and study groups so they could try to test out of some classes next year. They shared online courses and passed around job postings. Michaela Stretch is a deferred student living in Boston. Instead of going to graduate school, she's spending the year working at a consulting firm. But she appreciates seeing her future classmates on a regular basis.
Getting to know each other at all and just knowing that, like, we have something to look forward to has been really nice.
Deferred students are staying connected throughout the country. Core Barnhill has been accepted at Pitzer College in California, but has deferred freshman year. Barnhill, who is working two jobs instead of attending school, is in a Snapchat with the other deferred students.
I think that the group has been helpful in reminding me that even though we're all far apart and, like, I've never met these people, like, I do have a sort of community right now. It's nice to have some people, you know, however far apart we are, that know what all of this feels like.
Urban planning professor Ezra Glenn says he thinks the deferred students might actually be more prepared than past MIT cohorts he's taught.
We realized, wow, we really chose the right students. This is our group. These are the ones we want.
The deferred MIT students are planning to attend the graduate program in the fall of 2021. The school doesn't yet know if it'll hold in-person classes by then. In Los Angeles, I'm Alana Strauss for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out, Joe Biden, the next president of the United States, talking this morning about Janet Yellen, the next Treasury Secretary of the United States.
We might have to ask Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote the musical about the first Secretary of Treasury, Hamilton, to write another musical about the first woman Secretary of the Treasury, Yellen. So that's what I'm working on right now, Janet.
I mean, in principle, yes, absolutely should celebrate Yellen and running the CEA and the Fed and Treasury and the only person, also only woman ever to do that. But in reality, maybe not right now. All right, we're a little squeezed today, so you got to find your own moment of economic context. And yes, I realize that's like two out of the last 3 days I made you do that. Anyway, Digital On Demand around here. Ufuk Mamatolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner, Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.